Recording live from the ARC studios, welcome to the Sustainability Podcast. Our goal is to provide engaging discussions on a broad range of topics regarding cybersecurity, sustainability, supply chain management, plus much more. For more information and to get into contact with us, visit us at arcweb.com.
Welcome again to another episode of the Sustainability Podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by my old friend. It's been a few years, but Andy Bonneau has been a great guest at the ARC forums over the years. In past years, I even cajoled him into riding an electric scooter right into the session. So, Andy, welcome today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. You've had a very varied background, although it's been around the transportation world. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to this industry and how you came to sustainability?
That's a good question. It's something that I get asked more and more the older I get because I did not follow a traditional career path. But what I find is I keep looking back in the rearview mirror of life, and I'm like, wait a second, I think second grade me had something going, because I was thinking, if I could have articulated it back then, I probably would have said, is there a box I can check for class clown? Can you have a career in class clownmanship? Because that's, I think, what would have been the thing. My career started as Well, I tell people that my parents helped me buy a civil engineering degree, and then I did not civil engineer anything. But coming out of that, I started in transportation, not out of some lofty idea of how to fix transport systems or, I had some intriguing path in mind. But I started as a traffic engineer in a planning and engineering firm. And I mean, really just the beginning was like so many other college grads. It was, I needed to pay for gas and groceries and rent. And the occasional date night was nice to be able to pay for. There wasn't anything glamorous about the origin story. I think where my career path has been unusual why my career path has been unusual within transportation and urban planning, especially, is because two things. One is, I didn't have in mind a specific path, like this is the way you go up this traditional hierarchy where you start at the entry level and then you're the team leader and division leader and office manager and so on, and kind of moving up the traditional hierarchy. I didn't have that in mind because, frankly, I didn't know if I was going to like the work that I was doing. So why get all invested in that? And I didn't have, it wasn't like I went through an MBA program, so I didn't have a business savvy to understand how business worked and consulting worked. I didn't know that stuff. I was just kind of, I was learning as I went and asking dumb questions and being open to looking for things that I enjoyed doing. Because frankly, what's the point? If you can't enjoy the work that you're doing, why bother? So growing up in Northern Virginia, the suburbs of Washington, D.C., I was very familiar with traffic. And so that working on a team where our whole thing is traffic analysis and corridor studies around how do people move and how do you get from here to there and how do we make it better? And that was normal to me. That felt very normal. And so if I had an option between that and something like structural engineering, where I'm supposed to learn how to design a bridge that's going to last forever. I mean, to me, that would be like that. That's just the very high intellectual kind of thing. And I needed the Saturday morning cartoon version, which is cars stuck in traffic. And I'll work on that. So on the one hand, I didn't have this clear path of here's where I want to go. I want to go up this hierarchy, work my way up the totem pole. And the other was, I'm not bashful to say I don't know a thing and ask questions like, what if we do such and such? And not because I come from a position, again, of knowing things, because I didn't, when you do civil engineering, a broad degree like that, you don't have time in those degree programs to get deep in any particular thing. So I'm going to college in the 90s, so it wasn't like we were learning the nuances of electric scooters and electric mobility and that kind of thing, or mobility as a service, or, you know, what's any of that stuff. It was just shallow and a mile wide. It was just the basics of all these things. So I was just learning on the job. And so beginning in traffic engineering, just asking questions like, why, when I use this software program, why do I use these assumptions? Like, the default setting is 12-foot wide car lane. Okay, why 12? Because there's an up-down arrow. I can choose 10 feet, 11. I can go up to 15. Why 12? Well, Andy, we do 12 because that's how we've always done it. It's the default setting. And maybe this is because I've always had issues with authority, but I didn't like that. Like, this is just it. The reason is just because this is how we do it. That's why we keep doing it. That seems dumb. There's got to be another reason. After all, it's the engineering profession. All these people are licensed engineers, very intelligent people. And I just kept seeing that over and over again. I mean, whatever I was getting involved in and asking questions about, the answers would come back inevitably some variation of, we do this because it's the way we do it. And maybe one of the most shocking ones to me in hindsight was the NEPA process, the environmental studies that go and, you know, require traffic analysis to determine the level of impact that development and then transportation projects will have on the environment. And just discovering, again, by asking questions, oh, this whole process, this environmental review, it's not about protecting the environment. It's just simply writing a list of all the ways that you're going to destroy the environment. That's interesting. So it's not that a road expansion going from, you know, 2 lanes to 4 lanes to 10 lanes or however wide, it's not, we're going to question that. It's, well, did you fill out the right forms in triplicate about how bad the devastation is going to be? So just asking these kinds of questions, and then along the way discovering certain things that I really enjoyed, like I would come across a certain type of thing like access management or modern roundabouts or eventually bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. And I was drawn to those. I enjoyed it. And so that I would dig into it. I would learn as much as I could. The internet is amazing. So I would gobble up as much information as I could, force people to be my mentors, and then, you know, go from there. And I've found that it's not normal in this profession and in infrastructure in general to take that kind of path of finding the intersection of things that you really enjoy and the things that you're decent at and that there's a market for. Maybe that's too many streets coming into an intersection. Maybe we should go vertical. It's more like stacking. But yeah, it's been a pleasure in this industry because I genuinely love it. And so 25 years later, here I am still doing types of work about the built environment. Now the spin is, for the last few years, I'm entirely, I say I'm a storyteller for hire, but I help people with messaging around their transportation services, their design practices, if they're a technology firm, their integration, if they're a nonprofit, you know, how they can message about the programs that they're doing to improve the built environment. But still, it all has to do with how we congregate, how we move through space, how we settle, and how we enjoy the places that we live.
Well, Andy, that's fascinating. It was a very personal look at how you got here. It reminds me, we had one of the more recent and popular podcasts with Daniel Dennis, who runs a small sustainable engineering firm here in Florida. And we joked, and in fact, you'll even hear it in the audio, that we joked that we almost titled the episode, "But Danny, we've always done it this way."
it's the nature of the business.
And it reminds me that, you know, in our past interactions on panels and different things like that, you know, I was impressed by, you know, your, you know, critical thinking skills about why do we have a 12-foot lane width? Why actually is that? And I'm reminded of, I'm fond of the, it's a bit of an internet meme today, that the truth has no agenda.
Yeah,
and it's not fixated on the legacy approach, or just because something's new or different or in opposition to anybody else. And you strike me as someone who mines that truth and then moves ahead.
I like that statement a lot. It's another one is that I've hijacked from others. One of the co-founders of Netflix said that one of their keys to success was falling in love with the problem, not the solution. So, like, for them, the problem was due dates and late fees. And they were at a point in their history, while Blockbuster was still thriving and the king, where Netflix was falling in love with their solution to mail VHS tapes door to door as a way to compete with Blockbuster. And they were very close to deploying that as their full-on business when they kind of took a deep breath. They were evaluating their options again, and then right around that time is when DVDs burst onto the scene, and suddenly they could save a ton in shipping, and it just completely changed everything. And they realized, wow, we almost made a huge mistake because we were so focused on this solution of mail order VHS tapes rather than what's the problem. Problem is due dates and late fees. And then another recently, PayPal, one of the PayPal co-founders wrote a book, I think with that title, Fall in Love with the Problem. But the idea is just, what is the thing? What's the pain point? So if it's about traffic analysis, you know, congestion, what is the pain? Is the pain truly that a person in a car has to wait an entire 45 seconds or 60 seconds at the light? Or is the pain that you have a bunch of people that live in this zone over here having to travel only by car to that zone over there, and they're having issues getting there? There's only one way. Is that the pain? And when you look at the world or the built environment, or, you know, however tight you want to go like that, it, to me, it feels so much more freeing because you can find shared interests among conflicting parties. Like, suddenly a land use planner and a traffic engineer and a business owner and the economists, they can all come to the same kind of conclusions if they're all looking at these same pain points to relieve.
So the thread that weaves through this is, of course, sustainability. That's the title of our relaunched podcast here. I know you touch on many applications within the transportation domain. So where is that intersection of sustainability and transportation, and what's the current environment?
I think the easiest way to describe it is the planning industry is sustaining our dependence on personal automobiles. That's the harsh truth of it. It's really frustrating. And I'm one who has worked with both planners and engineers. I mean, even though traffic and transportation was my thing, rather than going the route of licensed engineer, I went the route of certified planner, or AICP. And then eventually got so frustrated with that industry that I let it lapse. But I know both of those fields very well, and they both prop up car dependency, which is so frustrating. And I'm saying this as a car owner. I'm not saying this as someone who thinks cars should be banned or that machines are only evil. I'm saying this as someone who gets really frustrated when a car is the only convenient option, not only for me, but for anyone else, because there are so many other issues, downsides that come with that. And so one thing that the industry, planning, engineering, local land use politics, what it overlooks is these conversations about trade-offs. So rather than just saying, here's the thing, we've got this new idea, we're going to widen a road. This road is busy. We've fallen in love with the solution of, well, we need more car lanes because there's a bunch of cars and we project that there are going to be more cars. If instead of that, they were thinking, again, you know, kind of these pain points, or like you said, what is the truth? What are we trying to get at here? What are we trying to resolve? Then you would look at these a bunch of different trade-offs. You would look at not only the obvious kind of environmental sustainability issues, but then the trade-offs of fiscal sustainability. Like, can the local budget or the state budget handle all of these extra roads? So even if you agreed locally that it was a good idea to add a new road or to widen an existing road, can you afford it? Will you be able to afford it 5 years from now or 10 years from now? Those kinds, right now in the industry, I would say, and I'm saying, I use that broadly, like the infrastructure industry, we're very quick to speak and then slow to act on the things that we say we believe. So quick to speak in the sense of going to give keynote addresses about the importance of sustainability and showing pictures of, you know, linear parks and wouldn't this be great? Lovely things. But then you go back to the office and where you have the opportunity to rewrite or abolish policies that prohibit the good stuff like linear parks or large parks or bicycle infrastructure. Separated bicycle infrastructure so senior citizens can use it, you know, all these kinds of things. It's not happening in the offices of the planners and the engineers.
You know, Andy, I've got a couple of layered thoughts here. You know, one is, you know, my background comes from systems engineering and the intelligent transportation systems world, where it's the waterfall model. It's very structured. You define your stakeholder communities. You develop narratives called user needs. You see which ones have consensus. And then later you go out for funding. Well, that, I was in love with that 10 years ago, did a lot of work in that area. But as recently, but the world seems to have gotten ahead of that. And it's gotten out of the hands of the professional engineers and the planners. And that thought was reinforced in my mind just yesterday when I live in Boca Raton, Florida, and I went down to Miami by a high-speed rail line known as Brightline. Some of you may be aware of it. It was my first ride on it. I was down in Miami in, I don't know, 35 minutes. I walked out of a nice, clean train station, and I was surprised not to see any bicycles. There was virtually no bicycles, but there was an awful lot of privately owned electric scooters. And almost no, public for rent electric scooters. But they were everywhere. They were everywhere. And then to top it off, on the way going down for a Cuban coffee, I met my first autonomous mobile delivery robot that I don't know if there were government documents in there or a pizza. But I had to joke around with it and see if I could play chicken with it and what it would do to avoid me. But it strikes me that, aside from the bright line, that scooter thing is just organic and it's going viral like the smartphone. And in a way, the same thing with this little, you know, igloo cooler on wheels.
Yeah, you're right. And an interesting thing to me about those, I like to connect the dots with different things that are often just disparate things, and because it helps me put things in perspective, and I think it helps others. Sometimes it infuriates others, but so for the scooter example, it is very easy. I mean, you want to start a verbal fire at a city council meeting or a planning commission meeting, say something about walking down the sidewalk and tripping over a scooter. Right? Like that, the debris, the visual clutter, that, you know, whatever. Those are real things, of course. You don't want anybody to trip over a scooter. However, if you consider the intensity of the debates around how many scooters should there be, what hours of day should they be allowed, where should they be parked, who should be able to ride them, what kind of clothing should you wear, do you need high vis clothes and a helmet while you wear them, all these kinds of things. At the same time, we've got people driving cars through houses, and we've got cars smashing into each other, and we've got cars smashing into people and bicycles and scooters. Like, the order of magnitude death and destruction from one versus the other, it's just no comparison. I mean, you're talking about something that weighs 200 pounds versus something that's 2,000 pounds, one thing that's capable of going 10 or 12 miles an hour and the other that has incredibly high up limits. It's one of those things, like the order of magnitude conversations. I think that goes into the trade-offs that I mentioned. It's something that's lacking. And the older I get, I think that, and maybe this is probably obvious to, to other adults, but, reform does not come from within an industry. It has to come from an outsider or from multiple outsiders. And I still believe there can be reformers inside of industries to nudge us in good directions. But I think for these kinds of things, planners, engineers, and local politicians are three different people groups that are very interconnected. But on their own, they both in isolation on their own, in their own roles, and together in concert, enforcing and creating local rules and practices. They're keeping us from having more of the good stuff. They're keeping us trapped in car-oriented development and expansion rather than thinking, like the example you use, oh, this is interesting. If they were to kind of take a step back and go, this is interesting. We've got these little robots moving around that, like you said, maybe it's classified docs in there, or maybe it's a burger, or both. You just don't know. We've got these bicycles. They're going the wrong way down one-way streets. Okay, you've got all these things happening. What does it mean? What's the pain point? Okay, the one pain point is for these robot deliveries, is there a place for them to be, or is the sidewalk so narrow that there's only room for this little robot device and you have to wait for it? The human has to wait. Or is it, you know, maybe there's another issue. And then with the bicycle stuff, is the issue that we need to outlaw bicyclists riding at night, or we need to outlaw bicyclists going the wrong way on a one-way street? Or do we need to think, well, why are they going on this the wrong way? And then you discover, oh, it's because the next street over, this very busy street, feels like a highway. It feels way too dangerous for them to ride a bicycle on. So I'm very familiar with the bicycling infrastructure in South Florida, and it's it can be hair-raising, to say the least. So I like what you said about the systems background, because that is a thing that's missing from, I keep saying planning and engineering because I lump them together purposefully, but planning, engineering, and politics at the local level, they're missing that kind of systems approach. How are all these things connected? How might these things be connected?
And a few examples, you know, come to mind that I do live in the city of Boca Raton, and there was a report out that discussed bicycle accidents in the city, and the great majority was on sidewalks. And people wondered why. And I know why. I'm a bicycle rider in town. It's because the sidewalks are safer than riding in the bike lane.
Right.
Okay.
That's a great example.
5 feet wide.
Yes.
They're 3 feet wide. They're 2 feet wide. That's one issue. But when it comes back to, you know, sustainability, we have the three classical pillars of sustainability. For those of you who may not be familiar with them or forgotten about them, the first, of course, is protect or preserve the environment, the physical environment. The second is the social piece, safety, good jobs, a vibrant economy, safe routes to school for kids to walk to school, all of those social things. And the third really is the economic one, Andy, that you talked about, because if we can't pay for those first two in some kind of financial model, they're not going to happen, and it becomes just an academic exercise. Because I came from I did a lot of work in the lighting industry. I'm interested very much in the effects and the evolution of the Vision Zero effort about pedestrians getting impacted by predominantly vehicles. And it's interesting that the safety community has required vehicles to be designed to a certain way that, if you notice, all vehicles tend to look the same today because there's rollover standards, they need large pillars, You don't have expansive glass like you might have had in a car from 20 years ago. But that's also raised the hood height on a lot of vehicles, which, drives pedestrian deaths up. And it's unfortunate that, you know, one set of stakeholders there is benefiting, those who have big cars, and those who are walking are not.
Yeah, it's an interesting shift that's happening. Maybe interesting is not a great word because there's a cause and effect here. If it's so difficult within a machine for the operator to see people around it, then people are going to get hit and injured and killed. And so you're seeing more of these diagrams that show, especially with children's height, how they are either standing in front of a modern pickup truck or SUV, or even in a line. There was one that went viral a few months back of I think the woman that took the picture, did the demonstration, actually works for one of the safety agencies that does vehicle testing. And they parked, it was like a Ford F-150 or something. It was some very popular selling vehicle. And they parked it on the street, and they had a whole bunch of kids sit down crisscross on the street in front, like one in front of the other, like ducks lined up. And the test, it was just a visual test to illustrate the cone of vision, so that the driver, when they're sitting up there, just a normal height person looking over the steering wheel and then the hood, where can I see the ground? What's the first child's head that I can see? And it was way out. I forget how many kids out, but it was a bunch of kids out. And then they had the kids stand up, and it was, you know, not as far, but still there were a handful of kids that were just around the front of the car that she couldn't see. And so it's an interesting kind of, it's a trade-off discussion. I think there's a bunch of trade-offs involved. You could on the one hand say, well, we need tiny vehicles because that's the only way to protect pedestrians. Okay. Well, what happened years ago when there was when we had tiny vehicles, there was a push for larger vehicles because tiny vehicles were getting crushed in accidents or crashes. And so that's a real thing to think about. So it's not as easy. This stuff's complicated. It's not as easy as saying small cars are the only cars that should exist, or large cars are the only cars that exist. It's all about trade-offs. So it gets into, from an operator point of view, how do you use this vehicle? If it's a vehicle that has tiny windows and not very many of them, I got to be very, very careful of my surroundings. And then if it's a vehicle that has a lot of windows, you know, I can see a lot more. That's great. It also, I think, opens up an opportunity to tie in technology advancements because, you know, things like a backup camera, something that not all that long ago, like you and I are old enough to remember a day before backup cameras. And if we would have said something like that to our driver instructor, like, well, one day I'm not going to have to look over my shoulder. I'll have a backup camera. Like, I'm not suggesting you want to let a computer take away all your decisions, but we know that a lot of people have been protected, property and physical bodies protected because of something like backup cameras or another technology. It sounds funny to call it a technology, but just the side view mirror to begin with, like even having a side view mirror on the passenger side, that came about because people couldn't see on that side of the vehicle. So then, you know, that's kind of the vehicle itself, issues with Vision Zero. But then another one related to Vision Zero is, how do you design the streets? Or bigger question, is it possible to design streets and systems in such a way that when drivers are moving through them, they're allowed to operate a motor vehicle, but it feels safest to go slowly? Like, the design encourages good behavior rather than bad behavior. And the answer is yes, there are ways to actually design street networks that encourage good driving behavior rather than reckless driving behavior. And it turns out that the streets, you know, as kind of normal design following the books, you can use the design manuals like the Green Book and state DOT design manuals to design for high speed and reckless driving, or you can use those same manuals and look for the loopholes and wiggle room to design safe places. And all these things come back to, I'm thinking what you said about the economics and the sustainable economics. That is a major part of this that I think planners and engineers are not tied into. I wish they were. And one thing that recently that I've been thinking on, I wrote a little bit about this, is the human cost of life. And if you were you're a cold-hearted engineer who thinks in ones and zeros, and you know there's no social aspect at all. If you only considered the financial issues and you were doing a benefit cost analysis of different forms of street networks, the way it is now, they don't properly incorporate the cost of a crash on a human life. If you or I get banged up and we're out of work for a while, the cost for us as an individual, the healthcare costs that extend beyond, the things that we have to do to reorganize our daily life because now we're out of commission, who's going to take care of the kids, you know, all of these other things. When that stuff gets factored in, the cost of widening a road or making it more likely to experience car crashes makes the benefit cost equation go in a very different direction than what you typically see. And it's very extreme if you include deaths that would likely occur at an intersection or on a road. And so that's the kind of very practical way that planners and engineers could take these abstract ideas of sustainability, or, you know, our firm has a sustainability statement on its website. Well, here's a practical way you can put that into practice. You can take these ideas of, well, physical environment, all three of them, the social aspects and the economics, looking at all of those and applying it to your day-to-day design work, we would have a very different transportation system and built environment system too. We would look a lot different. We would look a lot like older European towns, frankly.
Well, it's interesting, Andy. I I've talked and I've written about that all-encompassing cost accounting of an accident, incident, or something like that, and I never focused all that much on the individual. I thought that was somewhat implicit. I looked at what are those other dependencies that occur, like, if it's a minor injury but still requires an EMS trip, an EMS staff, who else is not getting that, you know, may have a fatal heart attack or something else. And there are, none of this exists in a vacuum.
Right.
There's limited resources to all of this.
Yes. This is one that lit me up on Twitter recently. I'll try these statements out on Twitter and fine tune them to see what's the most provocative to get people thinking on this. But I've said, do not ever, never, ever, ever let the fire department dictate street design. And the reason is they will, vast majority, fire chiefs and fire departments will insist that they need the biggest intersection possible because they year after year are buying the biggest vehicles possible and they want to be able to speed to the incident. So their idea, this goes back to the falling in love with the solution instead of falling in love with the problem. They have in mind, I have this big truck, I've got to get it to the incident quickly. But what happens, the terrible irony of that, is if you design the way the fire department thinks you should design streets, you're going to get way more 911 calls. So if you're public safety, is your goal to have faster response time, or is your goal truly to have fewer responses necessary, like fewer incidents? I mean, isn't that really what we want? If you are responsible for putting out fires and responding to crashes, wouldn't it be fantastic if instead of 100 dead Americans every day in car traffic, there were zero? Or, you know, if it was just anything less than 100 a day, that would be fantastic. And the way to start that is at the street design level.
I second that. I lived on it wasn't a terribly long road, but it was straight and cars would speed. And we attempted to do some traffic calming measures, but the police and fire department, it wasn't in Boca Raton, it was an adjacent community, said, can't do it. We need a four-minute response time. And any obstacle will drive us above that four-minute service level. But Andy, we have talked about a whole lot of obstacles. So where is the low-hanging fruit of applications that can have an effect for sustainability, either enhancing the natural environment, safety for people? What could an interested party do, whether they be an elected official or maybe just a citizen?
So I'm an eternal optimist. So even though we've been talking about terrible things that are happening, I know that things can get better in the end. And I mean, anybody that looks objectively at history can't help but see that pattern in all aspects of life. The more you learn about history, the more you will see things can get better in the end. There's no reason to be an infrastructure doomer, or a technology doomer for that matter. So there are, and one reason why I'm so optimistic about building better places, making better neighborhoods, more sustainable neighborhoods, is that so much of what can be done at the local level. It doesn't matter who's president. It doesn't matter if your team is in office at the national level. These big kind of national or global issues don't have the day-to-day impact that your local land use policies do. So two things in particular that have been happening slowly and suddenly are parking reform and zoning reform. And these are both kind of boring back of office policies that drive, pardon the pun, so much of how we live and move around, how neighborhoods are developed, what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do. I feel like I'm beating a dead horse with the fall in love with the problem, not the solution, but it's the same kind of thing. Like, what's truly the point? Are we trying to make a sustainable neighborhood, and sustainable defined, like you said, in those three key pillars? Or are we basically an extension? Are we an application of the automobile industry? Like, do we work for our community or do we work for General Motors? I mean, that's kind of the option here. So zoning reform is a big one, because right now there are so many things across the country that are outlawed in most of the places we live. Very basic things that most of us would say, well, that's good stuff, like a townhouse. I mean, sure, we all know or have lived at some point in a townhouse, but there, if you look at a local city or county's map of what you're allowed to do with your private property, and you look at the different color blobs, there will be mostly blobs of where you can have a single family house on a minimum lot size. So not only a single family house, but you got to have it on at least this much land. And then there'll be this tiny little area where they say, okay, you're allowed to have a townhouse in this area. And so that's why we see clusters of townhouse developments. And then apartments, we'll tuck those behind some trees or maybe around the corner from the townhouses. There's an even smaller area where you're allowed to have a blob of apartments or duplexes or, multifamily kind of development. So what zoning reform does is takes a step back to say, wait a second, is the idea to have these strict zoning rules where we put all these different types of land uses in different physical zones because we have oil refineries and tanneries in every town and county across the country? Is that really how we're developed in 2023? Or can we get past that? Is there some other way to keep the bad stuff away so that we don't have an oil refinery right next to an elementary school? And the answer is yes. It turns out, even back in medieval days, castles put the blacksmiths outside of the castle gates. Like, they didn't have zoning, but they managed to separate the kind of terrible uses that were necessary but not great to live next to. And the great thing about zoning reform is it helps normies see, oh, these rules are interfering with happy, healthy living. Health is a big one that I've been on recently. I'm working on a documentary that connects health and infrastructure. And zoning is a huge, huge part of this, because if you are outlawing things like smaller size houses, corner markets, like the idea of having a small grocery store at the end of a street that, you know, maybe it's got single family houses, but as a grocery store, a bar, a restaurant, these kinds of things that make sense to people, the average person, to integrate in a neighborhood. Because when you go visit some other place, you're like, oh, wasn't that great? A beach town, you know, picture a beach town. You got everything within a beach cruiser ride or walking distance, and you love it. And then you go back home and you're back to normal, and you feel like it's inevitable that everything has to be in drive-to zones. And the answer is, the bright side is, this doesn't have to be this way. There are a lot of small scale developers out there and builders who want to be able to take an old property like an old Southern mansion and convert it into a duplex, or make half of it a townhome and the other half a business or a restaurant. There are a lot of small scale developers who are actively doing those kinds of projects. They're out there. They just have to find the places where it's legal. And so we're in this odd spot where we have to do things like legalize front yard business, legalize granny flats. It's kind of a funny situation. Indeed. Yeah. Then the other thing, the parking reform, is just simply looking at your local policy and seeing, oh, we have a requirement that if you build this kind of thing, you know, fill in the blank of whatever land use, there is a minimum number of car spaces that you are required to build or pay for. And the idea behind parking reform is just simply, what if you take away that requirement? So a property owner, a developer, they know that they need to get traffic, and that could be foot traffic, it could be bicycle traffic, or it could be car traffic, depends where they are. But they know what they need. And if they're in an environment like a mixed-use neighborhood, a truly mixed-use neighborhood, they know they don't need a sprawling sea of asphalt. They just don't. And so many great projects, infill projects especially, are not able to get past the drawing board because of the minimum number of parking spaces that people are supposed to build. So those are two very practical ways that normies can, I say normies like anybody who's not a day-to-day planner or engineer, can make happen. But then also, even if you are in this industry, it's the kind of thing that you can just kind of on the side be like, maybe you work for a corporation that does projects all around the world, but you live in a particular place that has local electeds that are writing and updating and enforcing these rules. These are two things, zoning and parking reform, that maybe you can be an instigator for.
That is fascinating. It reminds me that, it's not like this everywhere in the world. For those of us who've gone to, let's say, the Netherlands and Amsterdam, very, very often I'll tell people that who haven't been there that, yeah, there's bike lanes, and they even have traffic signals for their bike lanes, and it works miraculously well. And it it's a very diverse community, and it works. In terms of some of those obstacles, technology, may well be our friend. So the first is, I'll just give a list of some of the technology applications that come to mind for me. And in terms of Vision Zero, many pedestrian accidents happen at crosswalks around dusk or dawn, and simply having contrast lighting dramatically impacts that. And that's not a huge saver, but it's also not a huge expense. It's just something that is good to do. Electric vehicles are addressing the whole CO2 situation. One of the more fascinating ones I only heard in the last week or so is ChatGPT or equivalent large language models are working their way into vehicles. And frankly, I thought that cell phone distraction issue was never going to be solved. But now if I could ask my car about what's the next stop or where or whatever, I don't have to look at my phone. And that may just be an incredible killer app that really, no pun intended there, but just works. So there may be things like that that come to us organically.
I like that you brought that up too, because this is another one of my soapboxes. It's as if you went in the cupboard and were like, what's Andy's soapboxes? I'm going to pull one at a time out. But this idea of technology, because I'll call myself an urbanist, but there are a lot of urbanists who stiff arm technology. Like, what are we going to do? Rely on tech? Tech can't solve all our problems. It's such a childish view of life. The alphabet is technology. Words are technology. Speech is a technology. Yes, it's terrible that humans are able to speak because we say things that tear each other down. But it's also wonderful because we can communicate with each other. We can build each other up. So any kind of technology, from the alphabet to autonomous vehicles, like, there are trade-offs with every type of technology. I think another one, I mean, you could hear my biases for bicycle infrastructure coming out loud and clear, but e-bikes are a fantastic form of technology. This is another great reason to be optimistic for a sustainable future is, if you combine what I said about land use, planning issues being a local thing. So, it doesn't take that much to overturn terrible local land use policy if you put your attention to it. So related to that, e-bikes, one of the big, you mentioned the Netherlands. In the U.S., one of the big points of resistance we get is, in America, and then fill in the blank with the excuse. It's too hot. It's too cold. It's too rainy. It's too sunny. It's like whatever the thing, wherever you live, you're going to have an excuse about why we Americans will never ride bikes. And I'm a big baby when I ride bikes. I don't wear bicyclist like kit kind of stuff. If I'm riding a bike to a meeting, I'm dressed for a meeting. I'm wearing a suit. I'm wearing like work clothes, work as in like consulting clothes. I'm dressed as if I'm going to my meeting. I'm not wearing special accommodations for a bicycle trip. And I don't want to sweat. I just want to get there. I'm not riding a bike because bikes are awesome. I'm riding a bike because I do enjoy being on the seat, just kind of pedaling through. It is fun. Like, you get that childlike smile on your face. But it's just a tool to get from here to there. But e-bikes are this huge leap in bicycle, or let's call it transportation technology, where even for 2 years in a row, they were outselling electric cars 2-1. Like, the highest selling electric vehicle was a bicycle. It's shocking, too, that they weren't getting press when you would see a lot of headlines about electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging infrastructure and a national charging network and all this kind of stuff coming from on high. And I'm sitting there, I mean, I'm not alone in this, but yelling at my monitor, what about the e-bikes? Like, this e-vehicle is outselling 2-1. This is a way that Americans, again, back to the local level, we can transform our local and regional built environments, even in suburbia. This is not about big city, because the e-bike, one, people can't help but smile when they're riding them. They enjoy it. And two, it makes things effortless. They are able to carry groceries, children, you name it. Like, they can carry a load. So if we think in those kinds of terms, again, like taking a step back, I mean, using your systems connection, what are we really trying to solve here? How do these things fit together or work together? If we lift this lever, what does that unlock over here? And so that's a really, I think, a huge opportunity in the suburbs, because we have so much land already in the public right of way that public works or departments of transportation already maintain. You don't need to widen roads anymore and take anybody else's private property. You have so much within the existing public right-of-way to make delightful bicycle networks that are separate from high-speed car traffic. So that's something that I think is fantastic for the future.
Yeah, you know, in my mind, this electric vehicle revolution is actually a continuum, because it's not just about bikes, but I mean, someone had come to me recently and said, why do I need a 4,000 pound ICE vehicle or a 6,000 pound electric vehicle delivering a pizza? Why can't it be a three wheel vehicle as they run in, you know, other parts of the world? And certainly in the U.S., particularly actually in Florida, the autonomous vehicle legislation that got passed maybe a year ago included support so that a three-wheel vehicle did not require a motorcycle license, for example. So the future is going to be an interesting place.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, little things like that they're so frustrating. But on the bright side, when you do see a ridiculous rule like that and you share it with other people, it can help radicalize people to help you lead towards happy, healthy communities. Because ordinary people just get frustrated. Like, wait, that rule, even if they don't have issues with authority, they're going to pretty soon if you start saying, just outlining those kinds of things, or like a bicycle that has four wheels and a battery is now considered a car and you got to treat it like a car. I mean, just silly things, silly rules that there was a reason on paper maybe 50 years ago that somebody wrote that rule. But these days, it's a silly thing. Let's call it that. We can laugh at ourselves and delete it.
Exactly. Well, Andy, this has been a fascinating conversation. We're nearing our end of our time together. We've got a few more minutes. What would you like to say to our audience that you haven't already covered?
I would say ask what if questions. It's worked so well for me. It helps put things in perspective. It helps you remain an optimist. On the one thing, I'm going to be an optimist because I have a cheery disposition, but also I'm right. Like, these things are fixable. So I'm right. I'm confident in this. Knowing that that so much of what we collectively, our industry has done to rip up neighborhoods throughout the country, it's fixable, and it's fixable at the local level. So ask big what if questions. What if this? What if that? What if we abolish this? What if we abolish that? That is the path, I think, towards happy, healthy communities. The only last thing I'd add on that is I'm hoping to be able to successfully crowdfund a documentary that I'm working on about this issue of connecting health and infrastructure. And the gist is, a doctor tells a person, this is what's good for your mind and body. The planning and engineering, the infrastructure industry, is going to hear that and go, yeah, you don't get that. So we have this conflict that we're not talking about. There's been a ton of scientific studies about this conflict between how our infrastructure is bad for anxiety and depression and cognitive decline. It's heart disease, cancers, just all kinds of things that are fixable. But this conflict between what the health professionals say we need and the infrastructure people give us is just, it's huge. And so I want to put a giant spotlight on that.
That's fascinating, because yes, most people do not get their 45 minutes or 60 minutes of exercise a day, and they just hop in their car.
All that and more optimism. I would encourage, I would steer anybody towards urbanismspeakeasy.com. Things can get better in the end, and I want to be one of the people that helps us get there.
You beat me to that. My last question here is, you know, Andy, I'm sure we have a number of people that would like to reach out to you. So can you explicitly go through, how does someone reach Andy?
You reach me on the internet, because the internet is amazing. And I can't tell you how many friends I've collected over the years that became in real life friends from the internet. UrbanismSpeakeasy.com.
Very, very good. Well, again, our guest today has been Andy Bonneau. Andy, it's been great to reconnect with you after a couple of years during COVID, where we didn't connect. This has been a fascinating conversation, and we look forward to having you again on in the near future. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Take care.